Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. The Dozier School for Boys, located in Florida, was supposed to be a place where young troubled boys could get a second chance, learn discipline, turn their lives around. Instead, over its 111 years of operation, Dozier became infamous for its dark history of abuse, neglect, and mistreatment. What started as a reform school designed to help juveniles quickly spiraled into a place of fear and suffering for many of its students, with a high number of unmarked graves being found in the grounds after the governor ordered a full investigation in 2009. In 2013, researchers from the University of South Florida got permission to exhume the bodies and run tests to determine who they were and how they died, and in total they excavated 55 bodies. And that's only the start of it. Today we'll explore what really happened behind the walls of Dozier and how its shocking legacy came to light. And I am going to warn you going into this one that this story is dark. Some of the stories that came out of this school from the children who survived are beyond imagination. They're really, really hard to hear. So if you feel like you can't handle that, I understand. This episode might not be for you. The Dozier School for Boys was a reform school that was operated by the state of Florida in the panhandle town of Mariana from January 1st, 1990 to June 30th, 2011. Yes, this only closed 13 years ago. The school was known by a number of different names over the years, including the Florida School for Boys, the Florida State Reform School, the Florida Industrial School, and the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys. Just for the sake of keeping things easy to understand here, I am just going to call it the Dozier School for Boys, or Dozier for the most part, is what is known as most recently, so it just makes most sense. But basically, every time the school came under a bit of fire and a new administration took over, the school would change its name, it would change tacts, it would change the punishment techniques and forced labour required of its students. In 1967, the school would have its name changed to the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys after a former superintendent, and that's the name that would stick for the rest of its time until closure. But when the school opened in 1900 as the Florida School for Boys on 1,400 acres of land in Mariana with no perimeter fencing, so nothing to technically keep the kids in, it was supposed to be this refuge for troubled children who had been convicted of crimes, these so-called juvenile delinquents. They were meant to be able to be sent to this school and receive training and education that would pull them out of this early life of crime, turning them into productive members of society. And this was the largest training and reform school in the USA at this time. But the whole idea of this, the idea of reform, fell by the wayside pretty quickly. At first, the children admitted to the school were found guilty of these big criminal offences. We're talking things like murder, assault, serious thefts. And this wasn't a jail, it was going to turn their lives around. But the law that placed the kids there was later amended to include pretty much any crime, no matter how minor. So you as a child committed any crime in the state of Florida, you could be sent to Dozier. We're talking tiny things like truancy, missing school, dependency, incorrigibility, like somebody who was deemed not able to be changed or reformed. Eventually, even kids who were found to be hitchhiking, kids who were estranged from their parents, even orphan kids were sent to dojo. If they had no place to go, they were sent to this school. At first, the children were as young as 5 years old and as old as 21. It was a mix of males and females, black and white, segregated by race. But it wasn't long until it became a boys-only school with a much higher population of black students than white. The idea was that both educational and vocational programs would be offered to these kids to give them a well-rounded education, which of course never happened. The first biennial report, written by Superintendent Walter Rules to the Board of Directors in February 1901, so just over a year after they opened, wrote that they had 30 child inmates over the year, with about 20 at any one time. They had 5 white boys and 25 black boys and girls. They had an array of sentences from 6 months to 4 years, and he noted that the sentences of those serving 6 and 8 months terms have expired and they were discharged without having derived any perceivable benefit. Such short sentences do not give them much in reforming habits and building characters.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Also, weirdly enough, the school also got less money for the shorter sentences, and less inmates meant they didn't have as many bodies to work on the land and make money that way. It was at this point, so very soon after the school opened, that the law was amended to allow for longer sentences, and it was also decided that the school would be able to decide how long the kids stayed and not the courts. The school which gets financial benefits for every child that they have there. And then it was decided that any incorrigible children could be sent to dojo without conviction for an indefinite period. So basically, even kids who have done nothing criminally wrong could be kept as inmates at dojo. And the school could literally keep kids until they turned 21 years old if they wanted to. Like, that was the deal here. They could receive a 5-year-old who had been orphaned or who was just found wandering the streets and keep them there until 21 years old for no reason. As you might expect, the school was racially segregated until 1967 with separate camps, housing, education, and work assignments. And naturally, the white boys were all offered the better side of the deal. The white side of the school was much more roomy, they were offered more educational stuff, they had the ability to get certificates, more qualifications in whatever it was they were learning. The white boys had the industrial shops, the woodworking shops, the kind of education that would actually be able to help them in the outside world once they were released, if they were released. However, the black students would be made to work out in the fields. They were picking and planting crops for state profit. Students described it as akin to slavery in the 20th century, but we'll elaborate more on that in just a second. Hold on to that thought. Whilst the white boys got somewhat of an education, maybe, the black boys were the ones having to do the hard manual labour, including looking after all the animals, all the agriculture, and the crops and animal products would partially be used in the school cafeteria and partially sold for profit. These boys were meant to be students rather than inmates. This was a school at the end of the day, not a prison. But built into the very bones of the school were contradictions. These kids were being convicted of crimes in a court of law and sent here. So straight off the bat, the staff had the impression that they were dealing with criminals, not children, and so they treated them as such. I mean, there were the orphans and wards of the state as well, but a good amount of these kids were convicted criminals, and I say that in quotation marks. And many survivors would later say that although they were sent to the school after being found guilty in a court of law, they had no idea what the crime they'd allegedly committed was. It's also important to note that a lot of the boys were sent to dojo on a peonage system, which is the use of labourers in servitude because of debt. So essentially, if a child had been found to steal something, they'd be forced to work at the school until it was deemed that they'd paid off their debt, as well as any fines that they'd incurred in court as well. But of course, these were children, often black children, whose families were living in abject poverty thanks to segregation laws in Florida. And the families couldn't afford to pay the fines. So here comes the school, here comes Dozier, saying that they can work on their grounds to pay off their debt. Peonage is also sometimes called debt slavery, essentially legal slavery. And here I do want to talk a little bit about segregation under Jim Crow in this time in the South, because it's incredibly relevant to what happened at Dozier. Up until the Civil Rights Act of 1964, segregation affected every part of life in Florida. And by the end of the 19th century, Florida also did not have prisons. Like literally up to the opening of Dozier, they did not have prisons. Instead, Florida relied on the convict leasing system, where convicted criminals were leased by the state to private individuals who could essentially do what they liked with the convicts. It was forced penal labour, which of course disproportionately affected black people. The 13th Amendment prohibiting slavery and involuntary servitude was ratified in 1865, but it explicitly exempted those convicted of crimes. And so the southern states quickly passed Black Codes, which were brand new laws that only applied to black people. Under these new codes, black people could now be criminally prosecuted for tiny things such as loitering, breaking curfew, not carrying proof of employment, and vagrancy, which is the crime of simply being homeless. And then once convicted, they could be leased out to employers where they'd be worked to the bone. It was legal slavery. And these new laws meant that southern states, including Florida, suddenly saw a huge increase in the amount of prisoners that they had. And this was literally for profit. There were financial reasons to arrest people. And you could argue that that hasn't changed, but we're not going to get into that conversation right now. In January 1883, Florida had just 208 prisoners. By 1904, 21 years later, they had 1,071. More than 90% of those were African American. These new laws, designed specifically to imprison black people and to profit off them by sending them to people to work instead of sending them to prison, weren't only aimed at adults, but children as well. And so a lot of the students, the black students at Dozier, were simply there for the act of vagrancy, of homelessness, of the tiniest crimes, because they could make a profit off of them. So the school was originally designed to reform, to change lives for the better, but it only took a couple of years until the higher-ups realised that that wasn't happening at all. This was a deeply racist system in a deeply racist state. And whilst there were hugely disproportionate amounts of black students, and the black students were given the more menial, labour-intensive job roles, the treatment once at Dozier was pretty bad for everyone. Like white students, black students, they all were treated pretty terribly. In 1903, just 3 years after the school opened, an inspection found children restrained in leg irons, something which it turned out was common practice. The report said they were found in irons, just as common criminals. Children were also found to be brutally whipped. This was no reform school, this was a prison for children. But if steps were taken after this point to try and make a change, I wasn't able to find any information out about it. It was just written in the report that this is the treatment they're getting. Oh well, let's just continue. In 1909, it was found that the school rooms, the classrooms, were in incredibly poor condition and didn't even have desks. So was there even any education going on at Dozier at all? In 1911, it was found that the current superintendent was a fan of unnecessarily and brutally punishing the boys with a leather strap fastened to a wooded panel. A committee found that this was more like a convict camp than a school, without any care for the sick, poor ventilation, overcrowding, and inadequate food, particularly on the black side. In 1913, it was reported that the whole place was just overcrowded, boys were sleeping two on a bed or four on bunk beds just squeezed together. In the first 13 years of operation, there were more than six state-led investigations into what was going on at Dozier, but nothing was ever done. It was just allowed to keep getting worse. In 1914, there was another controversy when about six boys and two adult staff members died when they found themselves trapped in a burning dormitory. There are conflicting accounts of this fire from the time. Nobody really knows what caused it, but the state was able to determine that the children who died had been locked in dark cells on the third floor of the building and were unable to escape when the fire started. And so trapped probably isn't the right word, because they weren't trapped because of the fire. They were trapped, locked away in cells by the people who were supposed to be caring for them. The school listed 6 deaths at the time, all of them were of white boys. It was in one of the white buildings, although the coroner's report listed 7 deaths, and the school also insisted that 2 boys were able to escape and run away. But Doja has a long history of underreporting the deaths that happened at their hands, and the families of those 2 runaway boys still believe to this day that they perished because they never heard from them again. After this, an area on the school grounds was designated as a cemetery, Boot Hill Cemetery, in the grounds of a school, yes, a school, reform school, prison, essentially. The remains of 3 of the individuals who died in the fire would later be found here, literally in the last decade, with a forensic anthropology team saying they believe that about 10 people probably died in the fire, so they do believe that Doja underreported the deaths. In the aftermath of the fire, it was found that the people who were supposed to be in charge, the people supposed to be keeping the children safe, had actually gone for a night out in the local town, and they were nowhere to be seen when this fire broke out. The superintendent was fired, and it would actually later turn out that he was a convicted bank robber, like seriously, and a new admin team was put in place with a new school name and new rules. And at this point, reform was taken out of the name entirely. It became just the Florida Industrial School for Boys, so the pretense of reform wasn't even there anymore. Over the next 5 years, the school would have 7 different superintendents. At this point in time, you've got to think of this as more of a business rather than a school, like it was all about making money. And their 2 most profitable businesses were brickmaking and publishing. In 1906, they built a brickmaking machine that made more than 20,000 bricks a day, all of which were sold to the local community, and any leftovers were used to build more dorms on the ground, more space to hold children that they could exploit for free labour. And they also had a thriving printing industry. They bought a printing press and created a newspaper called The Light. Soon, nearly all paper materials for the state government in nearby Tallahassee were being printed by the school. This printing business generated more than $250,000 in revenue. That is crazy money, especially in like 1906, like the early 1900s. And you could be thinking, like, brick making, printing, publishing, these are good trades to be teaching to these children. These are helpful skills for later in life. But that's kind of negated by the terrible treatment, like all the abuse, the neglect, the cruelty, the rape, the physical abuse that happened in the 111 years that this school was in operation. It doesn't quite balance. As the decades passed, there showed no signs of anyone stepping in to stop this abuse. Investigation after investigation showed that the boys were being kept in horrific conditions. They were worked to the breaking point, but nothing was ever done. In March 1958, so we're now talking 5 decades on, a former staff member went on record with the US Senate committee telling them about mass beatings taking place with wide leather straps. He said, "The blows are very severe, they are dealt with a great deal of force, with a full arm swing over his head and down, with a leather strap approximately 1/2 inch thick and about 10 inches long with a wooden formed handle." This staff member described this as brutality, but shockingly, this kind of corporal punishment was allowed, it wasn't illegal. This staff member came forward in like the mid-1950s, however, a decade later, in 1968, this kind of corporal punishment was finally outlawed in state-run institutions. And just a year beforehand, in 1967, Dozier was officially unsegregated as well. But nothing changed at Dozier, the abuse just continued, but now it was just a lot more secretive, it was hidden away behind closed doors and away from cameras. The same year, Governor Claude Kirk paid a visit to the school and he found a horrific sight. He found holes in the ceilings, leaking broken walls, buckets for toilets, and massive overcrowding. There were 900 children being supervised by 140 adults. It was the same thing again and again and again, and nothing was done to make a change. But the living conditions were the least of the boys' problems. They were much more concerned about all of the abuse, the physical and sexual abuse. You had intellectually disabled and physically disabled children who were at Dozier because they had nowhere else to go, living in the same quarters as 18, 19, 20-year-olds who had been accused of sex offences. You had adults who seemed to enjoy abusing children. You had contagious illnesses running rampant. Like, whilst there were the children in Dozier who were there for no reason, just for being homeless, for being orphaned, or for tiny little crimes, there were also the children in there who had been convicted of serious crimes, who needed much more help than just being shoved in this abusive school. Countless survivors have come forward in the past decade or so since the reality of Dozier came to light in the public, sharing the stories of their trauma. Because you see that whilst the dormitories were in generally terrible condition, they weren't really fit for living, they weren't the scariest place on campus. No, the building that the boys feared above all others was called the White House, where they would be taken for the worst kinds of punishments. Years later, once Dozier had been abandoned, explorers would find bloody handprints on the walls, scratch marks and fingernails, mattresses covered in blood and bodily fluids, or at least that's what it looks like in the photos. Today, there's a group of men who call themselves the White House Boys, survivors of Dozier who in recent years have come forward to share their stories. There's an article by the Tampa Bay Times that shares the men's stories at length, detailing how they'd be taken to the White House for the smallest of infractions. I'll leave the article down below because I highly recommend you go and read it. I'm not just going to regurgitate all the information in this video, you just need to read it for yourself. But I'll share a couple of the stories. So Willie Haynes was brand new at Dozier in 1958 when he found himself involved in a physical fight with some others after being grabbed as he came out of the showers. When the cottage father came in, basically somebody who was meant to be keeping the boy safe, and caught Willie with one boy in a headlock, he refused to be a snitch and share the names of the other boys involved. So Willie was dragged across campus to the White House where he was beaten. Multiple different men have described a one-armed man in the White House who was in charge of doling out whippings with a leather strap until their skin bled. Many of these boys, these survivors, believe that many people died in the walls of the White House, but it's all speculation. We'll explore the death at Dozier later in the episode, but there's no way of knowing. Ed Adams died in 2004, but he had been a student at Dozier in his youth. In the months before he died, which was a very slow and painful death in which he was abusing antidepressants, likely thanks to past trauma of being a Dozier, Ed wrote countless pages about his childhood. He wrote for hours on end. Now I'm going to read out here his own words, but please prepare yourself because this was particularly hard to read for the first time. I'm hoping I can read it aloud without getting emotional, but I just think it encapsulates the White House experience better than anything that I could write about it. So Ed wrote, "After I saw these straps, long ones, thick ones, short ones, they reminded me of razor straps on the side of barber chairs. I knew something horrible was going to happen to me. I was taken into a room and placed on a small bed about 3 foot wide, maybe 5 or 6 feet long. The bed was near the floor and had a filthy mattress on it. I was told to hold on to the end of the bed and not move or cry out. And then I remember the sound of something cutting the air, followed by a pain I can't describe. The most horrible pain a human being can imagine. It hurts so terribly bad. I would try and move to get up from the bed. God, please make them stop beating me. But they beat me and beat me so bad." And this was just one of Ed's experiences in the White House. There are so many stories that tell the same story. In the 1970s, a local teacher called Jack Levine heard about Dozier School and he decided to pay a visit. Jack was teaching delinquent kids at a residential centre in nearby Tallahassee, and they had mentioned rumours of Dozier School to him. So Jack became curious and wanted to see it for himself. So one day he drives to the school and shows his credentials to get in, and soon he is absolutely shocked by what he is seeing. He found this kind of lockup facility towards the back of campus, which is a jail within a jail essentially. There were these rooms or cells locked with metal doors, and he said the smell of urine just emanated. Jack asked a guard if there were kids in there, and he replied yes. Upon asking to meet one of the boys, the guard opened a door and found a boy half naked lying on a concrete slab. It wasn't even a bed, it was just a concrete slab. The boy was thin, small, terrified, and had no idea how long he'd been in there. The guard said he'd been locked in there for his own protection, as the older boys had been sodomising him with a broom handle. And so that was it. He was locked away for protection, handed food once a day, and that was it. Literally, this cell, nothing in it, apart from a concrete slab for a bed. He was barely even wearing clothes. Jack was obviously horrified, and he did bring his concerns to his supervisors in Tallahassee, but as we've seen time and time again, nothing came of his complaint, or at least not immediately. But this kind of solitary confinement was quite common at Dozier. There are stories of one 16-year-old boy who was locked away and ended up eating a light bulb. It's unclear to me what his motivations were in attempting this, like was he trying to end his own life or if solitary confinement had affected his state of mind as it is designed to do, but he did also reportedly slash his arm repeatedly with a broken light fixture. Solitary confinement is one of the worst things the human mind can go through, like there is a reason it's used as a torture technique. So for 4 years, Jack Levine fought for somebody to pay attention to what was going on at Dozier, to what he'd seen, and he finally got in contact with an attorney with the ACLU, which is the American Civil Liberties Union. In 1983, they filed a lawsuit against Dozier and three other juvenile facilities in Florida. Dozier might be one of the most famous of such facilities, but it was by far not the only one. This was happening all over the place. At this point in time, Dozier had 105 boys there, aged 13 to 21, and they didn't have anywhere near enough beds and facilities. Another inspection around this time revealed that the boys were being hogtied, so with their hands and ankles behind their back, and placed in isolation for weeks at a time. But of course, the justice system moves really slowly, even when children are being horrifically abused. It took years for the trial to come around in 1987, and it seems there was a lot of back and forth between the ACLU and the state, because obviously the state were Dozier. On the literal eve of the trial, the evening before the trial was supposed to start, the state agreed on a settlement. They said they would sharply reduce the population at Dozier and at the other two institutions, and the idea being this would just improve conditions all around. Less crowding, less boys to look after, more time to focus on proper care. It was said at the time that these reforms launched Florida into a new and progressive era in the way that they treated young offenders. After 87 years of mistreatment at Dozier and seemingly nothing being done, finally something was put into place. Was this to become a new era of good treatment, true reform, true help for these boys? Of course not, the change was very short-lived. In 1993, there was a situation like outside of Dozier where some teenagers attacked a couple of British tourists at a rest stop and killed one of them. There was outrage, shouts of the youth being out of control, teenagers being coddled, like the same kind of panic you see with each generation as they become outraged by the behaviour of the next. There were calls throughout Florida for the government to throw out the population caps at Dozier because they needed somewhere to house these very bad teenagers, somewhere for them to pay. It was unclear to me if this cap was actually scrapped, but the very next year the school was placed under a brand new government department, which was the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice, as they increased facilities in order to just house more inmates. So it seems to me that they didn't scrap the cap, they just increased facilities to house more boys safely and therefore they could have more people there. Or safely, in quotation marks. Because throughout the 90s and the noughties, there were numerous more scandals at Dozier, with 316 official allegations being made to the Department of Children and Families. Between 2004 and 2009, they investigated each and every one of these, of which 17 were verified and 33 were found to have some indicator of legitimacy. But there was no denying the abusement. Between 2004 and 2009, the department investigated each and every one of these claims, of which 17 were verified and 33 were found to have some indicator of legitimacy. But there's no denying that the abuse and mistreatment of these boys did continue well into the noughties, with guards and staff members immediately turning to physical restraints, to physical contact, instead of trying to verbally de-escalate situations. This long-standing culture of abuse and violence was proving very difficult to move past. I mean, you would think it wouldn't be difficult to just, like, not physically and sexually abuse children, but many of the staff at Dozier were able to prove otherwise. Like, apparently it's really hard to just not do that. And as the 21st century rolled around, it was very clear that time was limited for Dozier. In April 2007, the acting superintendent and another employee were fired for abuse of children. And at the same time, the state officially acknowledged the abuse that had taken place in those walls, as survivors who were now well into adulthood started to speak out about their experiences, and people actually finally started to listen. And the survivors are the aforementioned White House Boys. Dozier School was designed as a reform school to take criminals, most of the time not actually criminals, and turn their lives around, make them into these productive members of society. But actually, it just did the opposite. In best case scenarios, these kids left with severe trauma and PTSD, nightmares about their experience, but they were able to move on with their lives, get married, have families, hold a job down, and just lock Dozier away in a box in their minds. But not everyone was able to do that. Many of the boys left Dozier and immediately turned to lives of crime, not knowing how to process their experiences. Plus, they didn't really have anything else, like especially as the school moved into like the mid-20th century, the boys didn't really have qualifications or skills anymore. They didn't have any knowledge as to how to survive in the outside world. They'd been told they were criminals, treated as if they were criminals, so upon release, what else was there to do except to become a criminal? Countless Dozier students would go on to rape, to assault, to kill. And whilst, yeah, sure, there is always an element of being held responsible for your own actions, like you as an adult, you know the difference between right and wrong, you've got to wonder if they'd have gone down some different path if their childhood looked different. These boys were never taught to respect authority, to generally respect people. And you're probably wondering where the boys' families were in the time that they were at Dozier, and the answer is obviously different from case to case. A lot of the time the boys were being arrested and taken through the court system without any input from their families. This was the time in which the families' parents wouldn't have had any say in what was happening. And once the boys were in the school, well, that was kind of it. There was nothing they could do. And also, a huge amount of these boys were black, and if they weren't black, they were from the lowest classes of society. They were living in poverty. In a Jim Crow era, black families would have had very little say in what was going on in their adult lives, let alone have the money and influence to actually fight the higher powers when it came to their children. There was just nothing that could be done. If your son was arrested, that was kind of it. If you fought it too much, then you'd be arrested, and what use is that? And that's for the children that had families to even try and fight for them. As we've already covered, a lot of the boys were orphans, they were wards of the state who had nowhere else to go. In 2009, Dozier failed its annual inspection and it was found that the children were not happy. There were continued allegations of mistreatment by the guards. So the US Department of Justice conducted a survey of 195 different but similar US facilities, including Dozier. And in a 2010 report, it was revealed that 11.3% of the boys at Dozier reported that they had been subject to sexual abuse by staff using force in the previous 12 months. 10.3% reported that they had been subject to sexual abuse without the use of force, and 2.2% reported sexual abuse by another child. And this was pretty on par with the other institutions that were surveyed. In July of that year, intentions were announced to merge Dozier with another school, the JJOC, to create the North Florida Youth Development Center. But that idea was scrapped after budget limitations, so thankfully the state decided to just close both institutions instead. On June 30th, 2011, all remaining students were sent to other juvenile facilities in Florida and Dozier closed its doors for good. But it does seem almost unbelievable, doesn't it? This wasn't closed as a result of the scandals. There was no big investigation that shut its doors for good. In the end, they closed because of budget. In February 2010, the White House boys did file a class action suit for damages against the state government, which you would assume had something to do with the closure, but it didn't, or at least as far as the state has admitted, it didn't. The suit was ultimately dismissed by a judge because the statute of limitations had run out, and whilst this was all going on, there was also a Florida Department of Law Enforcement investigation also ongoing. This was in order to investigate the allegations of abuse, torture, and murder as put forward by the White House boys. They conducted more than 100 interviews of former students and their family members, as well as former staff members. But at the end of the 15-month investigation, no evidence was found to link any of the student deaths to the actions of school staff. Which is interesting because none of the graves that are known to be on site were exhumed in order to support that investigation. So how could they tell that? How can you confirm causes of death without looking at the bodies? Are you just trusting the old records? It does seem there are differing views from former students as to the level of the beatings, the severity of them. Some talk of beatings to the point of bleeding, broken skin, scarring. Others would say the beatings were usually warranted, they taught them a lesson, they suffered no psychological harm. And I'm sure that not every student at Dozier would have suffered horrific, traumatising levels of abuse. This was a school that was open 111 years. There were countless different guards, countless superintendents, countless staff members. Treatment would have been worse under some and better under others. It was announced in March 2010 that the state attorney announced there'd be no criminal charges filed. But the Florida Department of Law Enforcement weren't the only ones looking into Dozier at this time, as the US Department of Justice were also doing their own investigation. They found that the youth confined at Dozier and at JJOC, which was another similar school, were subjected to conditions that placed them at serious risk of avoidable harm in violation of their rights protected by the Constitution of the United States. During our investigation, we received credible reports of misconduct by staff members to youth within their custody. The allegations revealed systematic, egregious, and dangerous practices exacerbated by a lack of accountability and controls. We also found that proper supervision and accountability measures were limited and did not suffice to prevent undue restraint and punishment. Staff members often failed to accurately describe use of force incidents and properly record use of mechanical restraints. So yeah, two investigations, two very different findings. And as you can imagine, all of this led to a lot of media attention, bringing this story to the attention of a forensic anthropologist and professor at the University of South Florida, Erin Kimmerly. She learned the story of the White House boys and she decided that she needed to look into this case herself. As a forensic anthropologist, the idea of these sort of like hidden, unmarked graves at the school really piqued her interest. Through records, they knew about 49 boys that had died at the school over the years, but only 8 apparently had been buried in the school grounds. 17 bodies were shipped back home to their families, and 24 boys didn't have any listed burial location. However, in the Boot Hill Cemetery, there were 31 crosses, having been placed there in the 90s in memoriam, but like, that was it. The markers weren't even aligned with the graves, there was no information on them, they were just crosses in the ground. So where were all the missing children? These boys had died in state custody, but yet there was no record of them. They had been forgotten, discarded by the people who were meant to be caring about them. And it has long been suspected the actual number of deaths was a lot higher than 49. The reports from the time listed a lot of the deaths as pneumonia or influenza, which does make sense as the school was open through the Spanish influenza pandemic. Although there were also incidents of drowning, blunt force trauma, accidents, and unknown. In keeping with the pandemic, in 1919 there was a 2.5% of death, including the 5 victims from a few years beforehand, which did increase the numbers. By 1960, the frequency of death was 0.62%, which sounds small, but that's basically one death for every 160 boys attending the school that year, I think. Maths has never been my strong suit. Somebody fact check me on that. Like, that's what's written in my script, but I have no idea how I came to that number. That may be wildly wrong. Researchers found that the mean age of death at the school was just 14 years old. 42.5% of the deaths were of white boys and 57.5% were of black, which isn't quite in keeping with the ratio of black and white boys at the school. There was always a much higher number of black students. However, the high percentage of white deaths is skewed by the fire of 1914, where it is believed that up to 10 white boys were killed. So if you take away the fire, the percentage of deaths actually becomes 25% to 75%, which is much more in keeping with the demographics of the school. Notably though, the black boys who died always tended to be younger, and the youngest deaths were of George Grissom and George Chauncey Jr., who died in 1918 and 1923 respectively. Rhubarb, that's really rude. We're talking about something very serious right now. George Grissom entered Dozier School in February 1918 alongside his 8-year-old brother on a charge of delinquency, yes, at 6 years old, and they were both sentenced to being in Dozier until 21 years old, but they were eventually paroled locally and sent to work for a local man. And this is something Dozier did quite a lot. If they had too many boys in the school, they'd just send them to work elsewhere where they could be worked to the bone by somebody else. But just 16 months later, George was brought back to the school unconscious and soon died. And his is just one of many similar stories. And of course, although he didn't necessarily die on Dozier land, he was under Dozier care. Like, they were still his guardians, essentially. In the records, there are some very interesting deaths. There's 14-year-old Lonnie Harrell, who died following anaesthesia for an operation. 17-year-old Lee Smith had a ruptured lung after falling off a mule. Robert Gerald Hewitt escaped and then died of gunshot wounds in the chest inflicted by person or persons unknown. Guy Hudson was 16 years old when he was committed to Dozier in 1921. He ran away 3 times within the first 2 weeks, each time being caught and returned, but only 18 days later, so 30 days after being committed, he mysteriously drowned. Thomas Curry was 15 years old when he died in December 1925. He'd been admitted to Dozier just 29 days earlier. He ran away on the 10th of December and was then killed on RR Bridge in Chattahoochee in Florida, and his death certificate states that he died from blunt force trauma to the head. So there were a lot of mysterious deaths after the boys escaped from Dozier. They always died within a day or two, and a lot of them died from gunshot wounds. Nobody knows who by. Gunshot wounds by person or persons unknown, but I don't know if it's coincidence. Many of the bodies of the deceased were buried on the Dozier grounds, whilst others were transported back home to their families, if they had them, if they could afford a burial. And whilst officials have always known about Boot Hill Cemetery on the school grounds, the question has always been whether there was more than this just like one burial ground. Like, was there another area on Dozier where kids were buried? Remember, this is 1,400 acres. It's a lot of land to explore. In 2012, Erin Kimmerly knew that her and her team could aid in searching for the undocumented burial areas by using modern-day technology and scientific techniques. The team used ground-penetrating radar to identify where bodies were buried, but exhumation was proving difficult. The laws in Florida at this time meant that for a body to be exhumed, they needed permission from a family member. But these graves were unmarked. Nobody knew whose bodies were where. How do you get permission when you don't know whose body it is that you're trying to dig up? Erin had a lot of support in her mission. There were countless families out there who had boys go to Dozier and never come home, never having been told any information about their deaths or what became of them. There were so many families desperate to know what had become of their loved ones. So many families desperate for answers as to their deaths. But even then, they couldn't provide permission for exhumation because no one knew where the bodies were specifically buried. It was all just very frustrating bureaucracy. And then in 2013, Florida State announced plans to sell Dozier, or at least sell the land on which it sat for redevelopment, seeing as it was no longer being used as a school. However, a man called Glenn Vernadoe was actively fighting for the exhumation of his uncle, Thomas Vernadoe, and so he filed a suit against the sale. Obviously, once the land was sold, it was going to make it a lot harder to get permission to dig and exhume. Luckily, a judge did issue a temporary injunction blocking the sale until the time that Thomas's body was exhumed, and then state officials granted the university team full permission to search all areas of the ground for potential burial sites. And a search for burial sites was good, and permission to exhume Thomas was good, like a block on the sale was good, but it still didn't really mean much because I still couldn't just start randomly exhuming bodies. And then on August 6th, 2013, the state finally issued a permit allowing the team to excavate and examine the remains of any boys buried at Dozier. Finally, families would be able to get some answers. So at the end of the month, the exhumations began. As Boot Hill Cemetery was located in the area where the black inmates lived, it had long been suspected that there might have been another sort of cemetery area for white students, because chances are they weren't going to be burying black and white students side by side. This has never been confirmed, but a lot of people assumed there must be another cemetery somewhere. In just 4 months of digging, Erin Kimmerly confirmed that the remains of 25 bodies had been found, which was already way more than official documents ever admitted to. With the remains being exhumed, the next big job was going to get them identified, and they were sent away to Texas for DNA testing. And Thomas Farnadoe was one of the first boys to be identified, his family finally getting the answers they'd always needed. It was reported at the time that Thomas had died of pneumonia caused maybe by anemia. Apparently documents said that he was a very sickly child even before arriving at Dozier, but his family have always thought that. They said Thomas was always a very healthy and happy child and his death was a huge shock. But hey, there's never been a huge amount of trust here about causes of death. With so many of the remains being found in really bad ways, there's just not really any way to confirm or deny how these boys died. This search went on for a really long time, and in January 2016, the anthropology team issued their final report into their findings. They said they'd made just 7 DNA matches, which does sound very small, but it was expected. Like I said, these remains weren't kept in the best conditions in the first place, and then finding a DNA match relies on the family members having given their DNA in the first place to make said match. And whilst there are some families out there desperate for answers, the same can't be said of all the families. I mean, some of these boys would have died over 100 years ago, so they likely don't have any family members still fighting for them today. But on top of the 7 DNA matches, they did also make 14 presumptive identifications, like identifications without DNA, and the team do continue to work on the IDing. They're working very closely alongside the families. In total, as I said, they found 55 different bodies, but shockingly, only 13 of these were within the grounds of the cemetery. The rest were found in a variety of different places, like in the woods, under brush, under a large mulberry tree, on the grounds. And you would think that'd be the end of it, but in March 2019, there was another big clear-up happening at the Dozier site, and an additional 27 possible graves were found. A subcontractor found 27 anomalies in the ground consistent with graves. The governor, Ron DeSantis, did ask state officials to work with Jackson County to address these new findings and conduct more testing. However, I really struggled to find any more information on this. This was obviously over 5 years ago now, and the lack of updates do suggest to me that perhaps this ended up being nothing of note, but I can't say that for sure. If anyone knows what came of this, then please do let me know. I searched for ages and just couldn't find any articles on it. Former Dozier student though, Terry Burns, did tell Action News that if they searched the entire campus, he guaranteed that they would find another 200 to 300 dead boys buried in the ground, which is a crazy number. In April 2017, the state did hold a formal ceremony for families of the deceased and survivors of the school to apologise for the abuse they experienced. Two memorials have since been built, one in Tallahassee and one on the grounds in Mariana, and the families of the deceased can claim up to $7,500 to pay for reburials. But that's really about it. That's about where we're at today. The White House boys still talk about their stories. They want to raise awareness of what happened at Dozier, and they ask anyone else who sort of experienced the horrors to come forward and talk to them. Many staff members, officials, and even former students deny that any abuses took place, but I have no doubt that there were better and worse times at Dozier. There were the people who were treated better or worse, and I don't think that should negate the fact that some people did suffer horrific atrocities. I think it's quite clear that the grounds of Dozier have many secrets within them. They've been gatekept behind falsified documents, old staff keeping quiet, perhaps even officials not wanting to share the truth of what they know. No one wants to admit to child abuse, child murder perhaps even. And I wonder if the truth will ever really come out, but I know the White House boys are really, really fighting for it. Of course, they have received an official apology. They have, the government, state government, have admitted that abuse did take place within Dozier. But it went deeper. It went so much deeper. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I know this episode was definitely on the heavier side of things. This script took me so long to write, so I just kept having to like step away and take a moment. I had so many more videos planned to go up this week, and I just haven't done them because this particular script took me such a long time to just finalise and figure out how to tell this story. It was really, really a difficult one for me. So if you got this far, thank you so much for watching and staying this long. And I will see you in the next one. Bye, guys. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.